Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Yes, it is an Arsecast. No, your ears are not deceiving you. Yes, it is Thursday. And yes, there will be a regular Arsecast as normal tomorrow, Friday. But I thought, hey, why not have a little bit of bonus podcast action this week? Because, well, there's a lot going on. And although Arsenal still have something to play for this season, and that's something that does come up, of course, within this conversation, the Premier League season is over. And at the start of every Premier League season, I sit down with Ken Early from Second Captains, and we do a little bit of a season preview. And we always try and do a season review kind of thing after it's finished. So that's what we've got today. Myself and Ken will be talking primarily about the Premier League season, how it played out in general, not specifically from an Arsenal point of view, but we'll be talking Manchester City as champions, Liverpool pushing them so close. We will, of course, talk about the rest of the top four and Arsenal. And we also talk about Henrik Mkhitaryan, because we recorded this yesterday, Wednesday, the day after it was announced that Henrik Mkhitaryan would not be travelling with the Arsenal squad to Baku for the Europa League final. As ever, plenty to get through. It's always entertaining with Ken. I hope you enjoy the show. That's as much talking as I'm going to do for this particular episode. There is no end bit, as there is on the regular Arsecast, a bit after the music, which many people don't realise, but there is always an end bit, but not on this particular episode, because it's a special bonus episode, and those things are saved for the regular Arsecast, which you can get in your podcast feeds tomorrow, as usual. But for now, enjoy this. This is myself and Ken Early. All right, with me now to talk about the season and to talk about all the bits and pieces that have gone on between last August when we first sat here, Ken. Yeah. It doesn't seem like a whole season of time has gone by, but it has.
Yes.
It has. Ken Early from Second Captains, hello again.
How you doing, Andrew? Thanks for having me in.
I'm all right. I want to talk about the Premier League season and about all the various bits and pieces that have gone on, because it has been, I think, an interesting season on a number of levels, if not necessarily a particularly exciting one, despite the fact we had a bona fide title race. But I want to just start by asking you, because it's current at the moment and we're talking on Wednesday, it's the day after Arsenal have announced that Henrik Mkhitaryan won't be travelling to Baku to play in the European or the Europa League final. Just your thoughts on that situation and his exclusion from the Arsenal squad, basically because of his ethnicity, his nationality. Obviously, the decision was down to him, but having spoken to a number of Arsenal fans who are of Armenian descent, they very much understand why he would not want to go there, despite the various reassurances that were supposedly given to him and to Arsenal and to UEFA.
Well, it's a difficult situation, because I remember when I first kind of saw the story, I was like, well, he's banned from going. That's crazy. You know, how can they put up with this? But of course, he's not actually banned. It's just that he doesn't believe their assurances that everything will be fine.
Yeah.
So UEFA's response to it has been to very much point, just to load the responsibility onto Arsenal and Mkhitaryan, rather than concede that they gave the final to a place which was, which was had limitations in terms of, you better hope no Armenians are involved in this. You know what I mean?
They took a gamble. They took a risk. Like, it's a small chance that an Armenian could be involved, and we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yeah.
And now that they've come to the bridge, they've just basically blown it up and left Mkhitaryan on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, because it is ultimately his call, they, you know, they can probably get away with that. But I do wonder what happens. I mean, like, it's obviously a completely unfair situation. It's unfair on him. It's unfair on Arsenal. He's one of their, like, well, he's been good for them in the Europa League anyway.
Mm.
He scored one of the goals in the final a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Would he have been playing? Probably. And if they lose, are they, you know, what's going to happen then? Is it not a case that they can say, well, look, this is a joke. We've lost this game. We were deprived of one of our best players by factors sort of beyond our control.
Mm.
You know, I mean, what are you going to do about that? Like, there's also the question of Arsenal's own response. Should they play a game when one of their players doesn't feel as though they're safe to do it? You know, it's kind of, there has been, there was, I mean, we were talking about the other day on our pod about the Chelsea game against Hapoel Tel Aviv in 2001, which was soon after the September 11th attacks. Chelsea were drawn in the UEFA Cup away to Hapoel Tel Aviv. Well, obviously, they had a two-legged tie. They ended up losing the tie. But in the away game, six of the Chelsea players decided they didn't feel safe enough to travel. There was, like, Good Johnson, Petit, Ferrer. I can't remember six of their, Lissot was one of them. Six of the sort of top Chelsea players were like, we just don't feel. Chelsea went and played the game, lost the game, ultimately lost the tie. There weren't any repercussions for UEFA. That's a slightly different situation, though, in terms of, you know, you can't, you know, Chelsea got drawn against Hapoel Tel Aviv. This was kind of, it wasn't as though every team. What I mean to say is UEFA decided to give the final to a place where it was going to be a problem if
a certain thing happened in a certain set of circumstances. Yeah,
it's clearly something they didn't take into account. So they should have taken that into account. I think Koscielny was saying this on BBC, saying, like, you know, you can't give the final to places if everybody can't go there.
Yeah.
And so this is clearly a mistake that they've made. But now it seems to me as though they'll probably kind of get away with it. I don't know. I mean, with Arsenal, it's obviously a big dilemma because on the one hand, you want to show solidarity with your player, you know, preserve the whole ethos of the team and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not very US Marine Corps of Arsenal to sort of say, well, you know, this is unfortunate, but let's go play the game.
One man left behind.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's kind of a little, that's, it's not a great situation for Arsenal to be in. Like, obviously it's a terrible situation for Arsenal, but it's not a good thing for them to have done either.
Yeah, but
if they had said, look, we're not doing this, what would have happened then? I mean, do they just award the cup to Chelsea?
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah, and then Arsenal don't get to play in the Champions League. But then, you know, is that where that ends? I don't think it would end as neatly as that. I mean, Arsenal would clearly then have a case against UEFA. You know, they could sue UEFA. It's like, this is a joke. You know, how do you expect us to play under these circumstances?
Yeah.
And then it would be down to the argument of whether or not... you know, because you ever say, well, look, it's this guy's choice. We've got all the assurances from all the top brass in Azerbaijan. You know, they've all said, hey, you know, was the ambassador of Azerbaijan to the UK was like, hey, you know, you're here as an athlete. We're not here to play political games. You know what I mean? And gave this kind of...
Yeah, but did you see what he said? He said, you know, he'll be fine as long as he plays, doesn't play the issue as well.
As long as he doesn't rub his Armenianness in our faces, you know, he'll be fine. So,
yeah, it's a crazy situation, isn't it, for UEFA to have come up with. And of course, there are fans as well, leaving aside the general, genuine difficulties fans of Arsenal and Chelsea are having of even getting to Baku.
Yeah.
You know, this is a 70,000-seater stadium, two of the most well-supported clubs in Europe who've been handed 6,000 tickets each and who can't sell their allocations because fans simply can't get there. On top of that, there are certain fans who are being excluded from traveling to Azerbaijan because of their Armenian heritage.
Mm.
You know, how can UEFA stand over that decision? Because they'll say, well, this is about spreading football to all the places that football isn't. Mm. And that doesn't make any sense either, because, you know, clearly football is in Azerbaijan. This is not a new phenomenon that, like, all the, you know, all the people from the street are going to come along and say, what is this majestic thing that these people are doing? We must do that now. You know, everyone plays football anyway. The idea that you're spreading the game of football around the world makes no sense.
Well, there is a case for it, in the sense of, like, you know, all of these UEFA member nations, you know, it would be nice if lots of them are countries. I mean, like Ireland, you know, we had a Europa League final in 2011. It's unlikely we're going to have an Irish team playing at that level. How else do we do the football people of Ireland get to see top class European football other than, you know, being thrown the odd bone in the form of a final?
Turn your TV on.
Yeah. You know, I mean,
I know.
I think there is a certain case for it, but then that has to be counterbalanced. I mean, this is now, although UEFA are pointing and shifting the responsibility onto Arsenal, it's still massively embarrassing for them. The final is going to be a shambles. There's going to be loads of empty seats. I mean, maybe they'll be able to pack it out. I was at the Europa League final in Dublin. There was loads of empty seats. Braga against Porto. It's not really
the glamour fixture, is it?
And it was so cold that day. It's like the coldest May evening I think there's ever been in this country somehow. But surely UEFA must look at this and go, well, you know, just to avoid the embarrassment and the shambles that we've brought upon ourselves, surely we need to change our approach to these things. It's something that needs to be considered. Maybe it needs to happen first in order for them to make sure it doesn't happen again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It's a real dilemma. Like, I mean, I would have liked to see what would happen if Arsenal said, we're not accepting this.
Yeah, I kind of would too. There's a part of me that would have liked to have seen it. I mean, obviously, I want us to go there and win the trophy and get into the Champions League. There's too much at stake not to play the game. But as a matter of principle, you know, if one of your players is being excluded for reasons that are basically wrong and unfair on every level, however way you want to look at it, you know, there is that case. I would have been curious to see, but, you know, I looked at the UEFA regulations, and there's a fine, and you forfeit some of your prize money, and then you are subject to any further disciplinary measures that the UEFA committee decides.
I'd love to see UEFA, you know, meeting out the disciplinary measures to Arsenal for this. You know what I mean? It would be like, yeah, well, what are you going to do? What are you actually going to do to us now? You're going to punish us because we refuse to go along with this nonsensical situation. Mm. I mean, that would
be fun to see. You know, it's just, you know,
some allies at last for Manchester City supporters in the an Arsenal Man City anti UEFA alliance. Yeah. But I think a lot of people would be looking at that saying, this is clearly a complete joke. You know,
do you think it would be a different situation or something people took a bit more seriously if it wasn't Henrik Mkhitaryan, who's like the best player in Armenia, but not necessarily what you would consider a massive world star? Like, if this kind of situation were applicable to a more important player for Arsenal, for example, an Aubameyang or a Lacazette, obviously by extension it would include a couple of others in the squad as well because of that, but it feels like it's sort of, well, you know, Mkhitaryan, and I'm not his biggest fan by any means. I think he's a bit lightweight, and he's, you know, on his good day he's quite good, but more often than not he's pretty average. And I've seen plenty of Arsenal fans say, yeah, fuck, it doesn't matter, it's only Mkhitaryan.
Yeah, but you know, it's not about Mkhitaryan. It's the integrity of the team. That's really what it is.
Well, the integrity of the sport and how these decisions are made.
I mean, if it was, you know, if you're kind of saying if it was Messi that couldn't go to the game, then, you know, I mean, I think it has been a pretty big story, but it is the case. It is difficult to know what to do. Like, if ultimately Arsenal aren't prepared to sort of stand along with him, like, it would be a huge sacrifice for them to make. You know, they're missing the chance of qualifying for the Champions League, which is like crucial for them at this point if they want to make any progress over the summer. They're missing that chance and risking further sanction, but they would be defending the integrity of their team, in the sense that they'd be saying, well, you know, all of us go or none of us go.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a, I don't know, like, it's a difficult, because Arsenal haven't been prepared to take that step, we don't get to see how that would play out. Arsenal kind of have ultimately accepted or gone along with this situation. You know, they've said, okay, you know, we'll, you know, we're not happy about this, but we will
do it for Mickey.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe if we look at it that, like that, you know, his name will be on the cup. His name will be on their lips as they lift the cup.
Absolutely.
I just hope they don't lose the game, because then they're going to feel really bad.
Well, of course.
I mean, what standing on the pitch in Baku in a half-empty stadium, watching Chelsea cavorting with the Europa League, knowing that it was all for nothing, and then, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, yeah, there are certain things about that game next week that do fill me with a measure of dread. Obviously, losing is one of them. Mm. Olivier Giroud scoring the winner is another one. But that's a different thing. We'll see. But look, maybe it will force UEFA to have a rethink about how they come to these decisions. The question is, you know, we all look at UEFA and we look at European football, we look at world football, we look at some of the decisions that have been made over the last number of years, and I think we're all a little bit cynical about why those decisions were made in the first place.
Yeah.
That you don't have to be slapped in the face with a situation like this one to know that it's probably the wrong decision to hold a final in a city which A, can't cope with all the people coming, because the transport links, the infrastructure is not there to bring all the people who want to go to the game. And then you have this political situation, which, you know, people say sport and politics shouldn't mix, but they do. They have to. It's real life.
Politics has infiltrated everything.
Yeah.
There's no separation between anything and politics. I mean, not that there ever really was, but like, it's really explicit now. You know, there's no way to escape those links. You know, you can't ignore that stuff anymore.
No. All right, we'll see what happens there. Let's talk Premier League, and Manchester City are the champions, pushed very close by Liverpool. And I think when you step back and look at the way the season has played out, and you look at what Manchester City have done, and you look at how Manchester City have done what they've done, which I'm sure we'll touch on. Don't think too many Man City fans listen to this podcast, so we're all right. You know, what Liverpool did to push them that close was really very impressive.
Mm. City should be down on their knees thanking Liverpool for doing that. Because over the last week or so, since City won the league, there's just been this series of bad PR things happening for Man City. I mean, they won the league, that was great. Next day, New York Times, was it the next day or the following day, the day after that? But look, New York Times is like, oh, UEFA investigatory chamber set to recommend 1 year Champions League ban for Man City. They put out, you know, a kind of an aggressive statement then, saying, "Oh, this is a disgrace, and we believed in the integrity of this process, and now, you know, someone's been blabbing, and you know, we're very disappointed, but not surprised by this." You know, this kind of tone, you know,
yeah.
And then you had all of these people, Man City supporters, hopping on board with this and saying, "This is, you know, the New York Times actually owns Liverpool, and these salty Liverpool journalists, Tarek Panja and Rory Smith, are the attack dogs who've been told, you know, the New York Times, embittered by the loss of the team they own, Liverpool FC, has now ordered to release the hounds, and now we've got this smear job against City." Like, this is people are saying this.
The snarling Rory Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The mad dog.
Mad dog Smith.
Part owner of Liverpool FC. So it is true that the New York Times did own a slice of FSG, the ownership group, whatever they were called. Maybe it was NESV back then. But sold these in 2012. And I saw Rory Smith trying to point this out to people who were attacking him. He's like, look at, you know, they're all showing this 2011 link.
Yeah.
This link to a 2011 story. He's like, look at the 2012 story. That happened since. You know, we no longer own them. And that's completely insane. I can't believe that so many people believe this, have embraced this as a solution. Then there was the anti-Liverpool song on the plane. City put out another statement about, well, they emailed this one to reporters, but there's also like, you know, be advised we're taking legal counsel, you know, if anyone wants to link these things, you know, and that, again, that's sort of hostile, like, it's like, you know, shut up or we'll sue kind of thing.
Yeah.
Even though everybody could see what the song was, everybody knows what this means, you know, always the victims. We know what that, we always the victims. It's like, we're talking about a pattern here.
Mm.
Victims of it all. That's the phrase, and you know, it's right. Like, we all know what this is referring to. Battered and, you know, look, there's no need to go through all this. Everybody knows this. But that was another bad PR thing. It made the team look bad. The club's response, I think, made it worse.
Yeah.
Then you had Pep coming out and talking, starting to complain and moan about City not getting enough credit from the media. The media, by the way, who have just been absolutely getting milled by City's supporters and PR department over the last couple of days. They're not getting enough credit from me. And actually going to the extent of complaining that the Daily Mail website had Pogba at the top rather than City winning the league. Pep used his press conference to say this, right? He's like, oh, they, you know, I looked at the Daily Mail and Paul Pogba is the top story, having a discussion with fans. You know, it was the scene with Pogba being mad United fan.
Berated from the stand, yeah.
This madman is screaming at him about, yeah. Oh, you Instagram, oh, you lit this mad, like, purple face, spittle fleck, Brexity to rate. And Pogba's kind of, and this was the top story. And Pep was like, you know, it's unbelievable. And he'd been complaining for the last few weeks about this, oh, the media want Liverpool to win, and, we feel this and so on. You know, which when you then saw the Man City fan in the press box at Wembley, remember there was a video,
yeah,
and that was put out by Rob Harris, I think, where the guy is screaming, you know, you all, we're about to win the domestic fucking treble, no one's ever done it before, and you'll all have Mo Salah on the fucking back pages. That's exactly the same point. He's parroting Pep. That was Pep's point. You know what I mean?
Mm.
Okay, so this had been a kind of a bad week. Like, it's supposed to be a great week, and instead it was a really angry week. You know, you're all against us. But the point that I was making in the beginning was they should get down on their knees and thank Liverpool for making this season look like a competition.
Yeah.
Because imagine if they'd won the league by 20 points again. Imagine if Liverpool had done what all the other teams did, the other big teams, and got like 75 points.
Yeah.
You know? City would have won the league in February, March. This is all anyone would have been talking about for 3 months now. We would be in month three of Manchester City have driven a stake through the heart of English football. You know, English football, 1865 to 2019. You know, it just would have been this. There would have been nothing else to talk about. Instead, it was like, oh, you know, who will slip up? Will City hold their nerve? Can Liverpool sustain the pressure? Blah, blah, blah. You know, we're actually talking about football here, and it's only sort of in the last week. Remember, it's not because now that City have won the league and Liverpool have lost that all of the Liverpool controlled media comes out and now is like, oh, you know, you're ruining the game.
Yeah.
That's not actually what's happened. The sort of negative coverage over the last week has been kind of in response to
the finality, the fact that it's over.
The fact that it's over, the fact that there isn't football to sort of actually talk about anymore, but also the stuff about remember, why are UEFA seeking to ban them from the Champions League, why if the investigatory chamber decided, okay, we will seek a winner ban? Because they think they've broken the rules. City are like, we haven't broken the rules. You know, Tom Brady style. I mean, you know, we'll see how it plays out. But there is the allegation of wrongdoing, which is significant. Like, it's important. You know, they've been able to. If other teams have been playing according to these regulations, and City have been skirting around them and boosting themselves up. Like,
well,
people are not going to like that. I mean, it's entirely reasonable for everybody else to be like, hang on a second, what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, they have an advantage anyway in the sense that they are very financially well off. They've got a brilliant coach. I mean, there's no question in Guardiola's credentials and abilities as a coach. But having had those advantages and having this money and then cheating on top of that, it's a little wonder
people
are going to
be annoyed.
Yeah, but you know, also when you think about, I kept hearing this thing in the last week or so, or the last after they won the title, about how Manchester City have won 198 points in the last two seasons. Mm. That's fucking ludicrous.
It's insane.
It's absolutely insane. And it should be, you know, objectively, it should be a thing that people go, wow,
yeah,
that's fucking amazing. I mean, doff my cap. And you're not. Nobody is.
Everyone's like, well, this is it's unnatural. It's like a 9 second 100 meters.
Yes, you know what I mean? That's like, exactly what's going on here?
So, you know, that's why I'm saying they owe Liverpool one. Because if this season had been like last season, you know, last season there was this like the only excitement of like the second half of the season. I mean, if you leave aside, you know, relegation or who will get in the Champions League between Chelsea and Liverpool.
Yeah.
It was, can City become Centurions? You know, no one gives a fuck about that. Like, no one, you know, that's not something that anyone really was that excited about. I mean, it's a fine achievement, you know, setting records. It proved their standing as, you know, a historically great team. So I don't mean to downplay it, but it's not a competition. It's not a contest.
Yeah.
And if this season had just been more of the same, can you imagine how much worse this would be? Manchester City fans who are complaining about, oh, this is bitter and everyone's complaining now about the money because, you know, you lost, you know, suck it up. Just, you know, thank the Lord that it was 1 point.
Yeah.
If it had been 20 again, like, this would be far, far worse than it is now.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite funny because a lot of people... you know, tribalism and fan rivalry exists, and there's probably a lot more rivalry between the fans of most clubs and Liverpool than there is with those clubs in Manchester City, because, you know, for years Manchester City were sort of like they're the good side of Manchester because everybody hated Manchester United, so there was this sort of soft spot in a way for Man City, which now has become a blank spot or a blind spot, because if they win the title, everyone goes, what can we do? But also, I don't give a fuck because it feels artificial to me, whereas I know a lot of people were saying, well, if Liverpool win it, that's worse because I've got loads of Liverpool supporting mates. Mm. They're going to rub it in. There's going to be all that. You know, I was, you know, very much of the opinion that I wanted Liverpool to win it simply because when you look at what's happening, to give any of the rest of us any kind of hope, seeing Liverpool win the title
it could be done
and that it's not impossible and that we're not going to have 5 years or 6 years or 8 years of Manchester City steamrolling everybody.
But it didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
And that was with Liverpool getting a few kind of how did that just happen moments, you know, a few last minute goals you know, it was like, you know, how can they repeat that?
One of the questions I have here for you is like, can Liverpool do any better than they've done this season? I don't think they can.
No, they can't. I don't think they can do better.
So how does the Premier League become competitive again?
Well,
is the onus on the likes of Arsenal and United and Chelsea and Tottenham to be better and to take points off Manchester City? Is that literally the only way it can happen?
Everybody has to do that, you know, because it is kind of incredible when you look at it how, you know, it's just what a high percentage of the game. Did they win 33 out of 38?
Like, City?
They won 33 out of 38. Is that correct, or is it 32?
I'll check.
No, it must have been 32. 32 wins and one draw equals... No, 32 wins, two draws. And four defeats. That's it for 98 points. So, I mean, 32 out of 38 wins. Like, that's just, oh my God, how do you...
Well, you know, Liverpool 30 and then the rest of the top six. Chelsea were 21, Spurs 23, Arsenal 21, Manchester United 19.
Yeah. Now, what strikes me about City is, like, if you compare the seasons that they had, the City and Liverpool, the Liverpool games were a lot more exciting. There was a lot more drama in these matches because it seems to me as though they don't have the same effect on the opposition that City have in terms of, it's almost like a chloroform type of, you know, sleep now.
Yeah.
You know, just sleep. It will be easier for you and, you know, for us if you just sleep. You know, the City will score a goal and then it's like there's a total, well,
that's that.
We're done.
Let's turn off.
Because we can't get the ball off these guys. Yeah. You know, it's like... There's something really demoralizing about being a goal down to Manchester City, which Liverpool do not have this effect on the opposition.
Yeah.
They kind of leave the opposition feeling, we still got a chance here. you know, it's more like a normal game against a, you know, a strong team, that's probably better than you, but it's still kind of a, it's more like a normal or conventional game where you still got a chance, and maybe if you keep it tight, maybe you can get a late equalizer. Whereas with City, it's kind of like, we're done. Like, we've got to start thinking about the next game now. And I kind of get this impression with so many of their matches that it was over after 20 minutes, which has to do, I think, with the style of play, like, which is very much about monopolizing the ball, like not giving the opposing team a sniff. Like, they don't have any oxygen. Like, they just slowly, yeah, they just sort of pass out.
Like, it's a footballing python in some ways. They just curl themselves around you and squeeze.
And then it's like, and you just, this sort of, you're complicit in your own demise, in the extent it's like, we don't even really keep trying anymore. You know, we don't have a chance. There's no point. Like, there is a mastery in that. Like, that sort of, it obviously, the team that you're kind of reminded of a bit is Spain. You know, one of the best examples of this type of game I've ever seen was when Spain beat Russia 3-0 in the, I think it was 3-0, in this Euro 2008 semis. Mm. And remember, this is at a time when this type of football was quite new. Like, Spain kind of became even more extreme, like, in 2010 in the way they played. But like, a team that monopolizes the ball. I remember Russia had been this great energetic team. I mean, super, you know, hyper energetic.
And Arshavin.
Arshavin was just was lightning. You know, Arshavin was amazing. And they'd ripped Holland to pieces. Holland had an amazing group stage, smashed France and Italy, then got overrun by Russia. Mm. And it was all, oh, you know, Russia against Spain. This is quite interesting now. Spain had beaten Russia 4-1 in the group, but it was like, oh, Russia, they've got Arshavin now. They're much better. And it was like, there was no, like, it was like the match did not take place. It was just like Spain have the ball, just passing it around to each other. And eventually, you just see the Russian heads going down. Like, we can't, like, what?
How?
We don't even really understand what we're up against here. Like, this is something we've never encountered before. And the demoralization, like the mastery that Spain had, that was like a new thing to see for me anyway at that time. Barcelona, that's the same summer that Guardiola started at Barcelona. And obviously they then made this type of thing famous. You know, like, you can't get the ball off us. Like, what are you going to do now? Mm. And I get the impression, you know, eventually teams started to figure out things that they could do. Premier League teams need to start figuring that out. Like, City are not an unbeatable team. I mean, Tottenham showed this. Newcastle obviously beat them. There are random games. Palace, you know, the Palace game had like a miracle goal in it. You know, maybe it does take something like that. But it also, you have to kind of keep competing. And it seemed to me a lot of the teams in the Premier League were intimidated by City to the level where they were like, yeah, all right, you know, we weren't expected to get any points out of this game. So let's go.
Isn't it somewhat ironic that a potential Champions League ban could only serve to make Manchester City more dominant domestically?
What is it, 114 points they can get? Yeah. That would be just a 38 game. I don't know what they'd come up with after like Centurions and Formidables.
Yeah.
For like just
whatever, 111, maybe they get 111 points. They can be the fucking Bilbo Baggins champions.
Oh yeah. Now it's like, I mean, that could happen. I mean, that is what would happen if it was to be the case that Pep would be like, I'm out. I mean, I think the situation with Pep is interesting because you saw what happened after the FA Cup final.
What did you make of that? Because I thought it was, like, if someone sits there and accuses you, not accuses you, but asks you if you've taken illicit payments, if you haven't taken illicit payments, then I think you've got every right to be unhappy about that. But I feel sometimes with Pep that there is a measure of, I won't say theatrics because it's not really flamboyant enough to be theatrics, but a sort of a manufactured persona in that I'm sure they've had conversations behind the scenes at Manchester City about how to react if you're asked about the financial situation of the club or any potential benefit to you. Even the Raheem Sterling thing after the final. Mm. And he's there and he's like super intense and he's at Sterling. It's like, you know, hang on a second. You can't, on the one hand, complain to this journalist that he's asked you a difficult question after you've completed a treble when you straight after completing a treble, you're not fucking happy. You're laying into fucking one of your players because he just made sure that the ball went over the line, you know.
Yeah. Is that what it was? Have they mentioned that? Because I was wondering if that was what he was.
I just looked it up, and basically, hang on. This is from 2 days ago. It's from a website I don't really know, but apparently Sterling said, he just said, I shouldn't have tried to steal that first goal.
Okay, yeah, well,
stealing a goal, like, you know.
Yeah. I mean, Sterling also said after the game that, you know, he's just fining us the whole time. He brought in fines, you know, we're being fined for all the little mistakes we make.
Like, but we're being fined for on-pitch mistakes.
No, fined for stuff to do with, you know, the training. Like, it just struck me as funny that Sterling, after in his on-field, like, BT Sport interview, when asked, you know, what is the secret of, you know, Pep's incredible success, was like, well, you know, fines was one of the first things that came to his mind. Like, he's really ramped up the findings this season, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that was kind of... But, like, okay, the question was put to him, and his response was angry. Now, I thought his response was perfectly consistent with somebody who was totally innocent of what's being implied by the question. It's perfectly consistent with that. It's also consistent with somebody who, you know, who had done what the question was asking him. The reason the question is legitimate, I think, is that Rob Harris, who was the journalist who asked it, was saying, I've asked this to City, they won't answer me. Where else? You might say this isn't the time and place, but where exactly is?
There is no way. I mean, you don't get to ask that question in a sit-down one-on-one with Pep Guardiola. You don't get to ask that question because it's off the table before you start. Or if you do ask it, then you're out. Interview's over, and they'll probably, you know, take the film out of your camera, metaphorically speaking.
Answer the question of whether such a question should even be put to Guardiola if it's insulting to do that. Well, the thing is that the basis of the question is this happened with your predecessor, with one of your predecessors, Roberto Mancini. Do you has something similar happened with you? Do you have a similar arrangement with the club? Like it could be a case of how dare he say this, you know, there's nothing to link Guardiola with this apart from the fact that he works for City, and this is their methodology. Happened before, therefore it's for that reason it's a legitimate question. Guardiola didn't deny it, and he continues
not to deny it.
Well, look, you know, I mean, Guardiola, I'm not sure how much he was thinking about the question, because you could see the anger was real.
Yeah.
And there's a number of reasons why he could have been angry with it, but, you know, if even if he had time to think about it, could he definitely deny that? I mean, he's been working for City for how long? You know, he's been flying over to Abu Dhabi. Has everything that he's done been exactly related to his job as Man City coach? You know, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's lots of things. Maybe he denies it. He thinks it's not true. And then it turns out, oh, he did this thing. And you know what I mean? Like he turned up at some shopping center opening or whatever. And like, I'm speaking completely hypothetically here.
Yeah.
He may not have been in a position even to give a definite denial. He may not even have known exactly. I mean, Guardiola's got so much money. I was actually thinking about this the other day. Like, how much time do you think he spends managing his money? Like, he must have like 100 million euros at this stage.
I guess. I don't know. I mean,
he was obviously rich from playing football. Then he was managing Barcelona. Big pay, big bonuses. Managed Bayern was at like 15 million euros a year. City, it's like closer to 20 million euros a year. I mean, the guy, like,
plus bonuses.
Yeah, so where, you know, how much time, if you had 100 million, like, how much time would you spend managing your portfolio?
He clearly doesn't spend any time managing his money because he's sitting upstairs watching videos and drawing little diagrams of, you know, how his right wing back can expose Brighton's inside right forward, you know. It is a weird thing. I mean, he said, didn't he, you know, after that, when he was asked about the finances, you know, the owners tell me everything is
Pontius Pilate.
I believed them. The only thing is
I accept their assurance.
Pretty much nobody else in the world of football believes them when they say it's all above board.
Well, you know, it's just that these football leaks emails and so on, which they, you know, it's a clear and organized attempt to damage the reputation of the club. Was that their boilerplate that they kept putting out? You know, but again, they weren't saying these documents are made up.
No.
You know what I mean? They were saying, oh, these are hacked documents, you know, which So there was a difference between what they'd been saying in public and what these documents seemed to suggest were going on. So
sure.
when those sorts of things happen, that's what undermines the credibility. You know, that's why Pep ends up getting asked a question like that.
Yeah.
You know, you can say, oh, this is appalling. How dare the journalists spoil such a great moment by this? But like, this is the cost of doing business in the way these leaks suggest it's been done.
Mm.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Let's talk a little bit about what happened below City and Liverpool. And it was a weird end to the season, certainly from an Arsenal point of view. It was a really bad end to the season because top four should have been secured. And there seemed to be, across the four teams who were there for the two places to finish in the top four, a reluctance to take the bull by the horns, if you like. I mean, have you any theories as to why... at a time of the season when points were so important, I know there was a certain amount of European involvement for Arsenal, for Chelsea, also Tottenham as well. I mean, was that a big factor in them taking their eye off the ball a bit domestically?
Well, all of the teams got tired and none of them were really that good. So the edge they had over the kind of teams they were playing was kind of down to zero.
Mm.
And the results had become random in those games. You know, games you expect Arsenal, Tottenham, Chelsea, Man United to some extent to be able to beat mid-table teams, but tired, injured squads, like, why should they have no divine right to win these matches, you know what I mean?
No.
So Tottenham obviously were falling apart, and knowing that they were going to the Champions League final or had a great chance of getting there obviously became their priority. You know, I mean, I can't not I think a similar thing happened last season with Liverpool when they got past City and it looked as though they could get to the final. Suddenly their performances in the league started going a little off the boil, although they did make it in the end. I mean, in the case of Manchester United, I mean, that's just... there, obviously, it's a sort of a special case. With Arsenal, I guess the Ramsey injury was important.
Mm.
Did he get injured against Napoli?
Yeah, away to Napoli in the second leg, so...
You know, like, I mean, I think he was a bad time to lose him.
Yeah.
I don't know what was happening with Mustafi. you can't explain it. Like, you can't... There's no explanation. He just had a pretty bad few weeks there.
Yeah.
I mean, like, what can you say about that? Like, nobody saw that coming. Like, Arsenal were the team that looked most likely to finish third at one point.
Yeah.
And then just,
yeah.
I mean, if it could be explained, like, there is no explanation.
Yeah, I suppose.
What's your theory?
My theory is that we fucked up the Crystal Palace game by picking a weak team, and then it was going all right. It was 1-1, and then Mustafi did that crazy thing where he just stopped and let Zaha in, and then they scored again, and that was 3-1. And then in order to make up for that, he had to go to Wolves and play a way that I don't think he wanted to play against Wolves, but he needed 3 points, and we lost that game, and then the Leicester game. So I think it was a slight kick on from that. I mean, look, it's been a long season, but being where we were with 5 or 6 games to play against some of the teams that you on paper would say Arsenal should do better against, I think it was 4 points from 18, you know, in the end, and maybe 7 points from 21 in the end, you know, with the win over Burnley on the final day, which was irrelevant. But you know, I think that was a really disheartening part of the season, actually, because, you know, Emery's been up and down, and there've been some really good things about the season, some dodgy things about the season. Defensively, obviously not great. Over the course of the season, the two strikers have become very, very important, and we're leaning on them a great deal. But it sort of colours my view of what he's done this season, as much as I try and step back and look at it objectively. When you talk about expectations at the start of the season, that's fine, but when you're five or six games from the end and you're in a great position and you fuck it up, basically, yeah, you know, it has to have an impact. But clearly he can make a real genuine success of his first season at Arsenal by winning the Europa League. It's, yeah, you know, it's
his special power.
That's what it is. It was interesting, actually, the managing director and the head of football, Raul Sanyehi, did an interview on the official website this week, and Sanyehi actually spoke about how that was a factor in their recruitment of Emery.
The fact that he wins the Europa League.
Yeah, he's a Europa League. He says he wins finals, he wins the Europa League, let's hope he can do it again. And he said that was part of our thinking when they hired him.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, ideally you want that to translate into the Champions League. To be honest, I don't see any reason why it shouldn't. You know, he just happens to be managing teams that were mainly in the Europa League. You know, it's not as though it doesn't work in the more important European competition. What I would like to hear Sanyehi, though, talk a bit more about how certain other things have happened at Arsenal since he's been there, which I would have imagined his role was to make sure didn't happen.
Such as?
Well, monumental fuck-ups, like letting Aaron Ramsey leave on a free transfer and signing Mesut Ozil up to a contract which is now almost a Sanchez-level disaster.
That was basically before him. The Ozil contract was before him.
That was January 2018.
Yeah, he just came in he came at the end of January, the end of February.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he was sort of, everyone knew he was coming, but basically that was a Wenger/Gazidis.
I thought Wenger was against it.
He was against the level of salary. He wasn't necessarily against the extension, but he was definitely against the level of salary. But yeah, I mean, that's a situation that I think they're going to deal with.
Like, do you think they're going to just have to pay him off?
I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Because they again, in this interview, they talked about the wage bill and how they need to use the wage bill more efficiently. $350,000 a week off the wage bill on top of losing Cech's wages, Ramsey's wages, Welbeck's wages, and when they move on, you know, Mustafi, for example, and Jenkinson, a couple of people like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big, big saving off the wage bill. I mean, it has been, since he signed that contract, pretty much a disaster.
Yeah.
You know, he's had these incredible moments, you know, he's invented this choppy goal finish, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But he's only made four assists since he signed that new contract. And, you know, things haven't always been great behind the scenes. And there's been, if we talk about Manchester City having a PR machine, Mesut Ozil's got one as well. In the last few weeks, his agent has been very clear, you know, he wants to stay, he loves the club, blah, blah, blah. So to me, it feels like they're trying to get out ahead of that. But, you know, he feels like a player Arsenal need to move on from now, from my point of view anyway, because he represents something that isn't there anymore and it's not the future.
Yeah, I mean, someone had a screen grab of, like, you would have seen it, I'm sure, was it the last day of the season? And, like, it was just a screen grab of their phone and, you know, the Arsenal team news was, like, the first alert, but then another alert was theirs. Mesut Ozil is live on Twitch. You're like, Mesut. But that to me is like, okay, something strange is going on here. Like, he doesn't have, he should have the awareness not to do that. He's gone past caring about that kind of stuff now.
Yeah, somebody said that it wasn't him, that it was one of his Fortnite team, but even so, you know, just, in the hour
just go
before
incognito. Like, come on, this is the, you know, you got to try and make some sort of concessions here to trying to give the right, put across the right impression.
Yeah,
I don't care if you're sitting there playing Fortnite because you're not involved in the game. Like, it doesn't actually matter. But don't try not to advertise to the world. Like, the fact that he's not prepared to even sort of do those sorts of things,
yeah,
suggests to me like there's something unusual here. Like it's not like the normal. I don't know what is going on with him, but it doesn't look to me like he's going to really ever recapture this fire. I mean, Mesut has been a great player.
Yeah,
you know, he's won a lot of stuff. He's played in great teams. He hasn't. Well, he's won a few things with Arsenal as well, to be fair. But you know, I don't know. You can't have a player earning that much money and contributing that little. It ruins the club, because the good players are like, well, why is he getting paid more than me? I should be paid more than him. I'm obviously doing way more. And all of the players are taking the, like, this guy is basically, because of the money, the top player in the hierarchy of the dressing room, and he's not a good example. And what's this? You can't work with that. You know what I mean? And it's clear that, like, Emery has had this weird relationship with him, where at first it looked as though he was going to take a real hard line and be like, you know, I'm not having this, you're out. And then he kind of softened and started using him and fiddling around the formation to find a way to play him. And it looked as though maybe this might work.
Yeah.
He scored that amazing goal, was it against Leicester?
Yeah, he played really well. A great performance against Leicester. I can't remember who the goals were against at this point.
But like, you know, it's not enough, really.
No.
And now I think, okay, they have to make a decision, but it's going to be really expensive. It's a bit like Bale, you know, at Real Madrid. It's
yeah.
like, want to get rid of him? They're like, okay, well, pay me then. You know, you're the ones who agreed to pay me 17 or 18 million euros a year. Give me my money and you won't have to see me anymore.
Yeah, I think they will. I think they will try and move him on. I think they're just going to take a big financial hit.
Mm.
And that will be that. How they redistribute.
It's the best thing to do, I think, at this point, because it's just, you have to take into account the effect that has on all the other players and on the team. And, you know, it would just be better to make a clean break and hopefully not make another mistake quite as catastrophic as that in the next couple of years.
Yeah, well, we'll see who they get to bring in this summer. You know, there's a new technical director coming in. They got rid of their head of recruitment, which is not ideal going into a transfer window.
Did he not leave because his nose was out of joint?
Sort of, but he was, yeah, the story was he was promised the role of technical director by Ivan Gazidis. Of course, Ivan Gazidis fucked off to Milan as quickly as he could, which to me doesn't really augur well for what's coming. But hey, not that I'm a fan of Ivan Gazidis, I'm quite happy never to have to listen to him ever again. But yeah, it's not as healthy or as efficient behind the scenes as you would like going into a big summer, because I think Arsenal really do need a big summer, don't they, in terms of squad rebuilding?
How are they going to do it?
I don't know.
If they don't win that Europa League final, then what's...
The budget is somewhere in the region of £40 million.
So what can you get with that? Like,
yeah,
could you buy Aaron Wan-Bissaka for £40 million? Probably not.
No.
You know, I'm not suggesting he would be the you know, he's the missing...
Well, you couldn't get Wilfred Zaha, probably, for 40 million.
No, well, no way. I mean, no way could you get Zaha.
You know, so...
I mean, this is nuts. Like, it's actually insane how much... you know, say an example would be Sané. You know, how much did Sané cost Man City? Like 30 million or something like that? That's only a couple of years ago. Now they're talking about, you know, Pep is like, oh, I'm not sure. I think Sané maybe not... You know, he may be only 99% of the player I hoped he was, you know, for he, you know, a guy who'd walk into almost every other team in the world. But I'm kind of like not sure about his attitude. And and if Bayern wants to sign him, then okay, you know, I can live with that. But he'll cost like 100 million euros. It's like, how does that make any form of sense?
Yeah.
I mean, he's a really good player. He's brilliant, one of the best in the world in his position. But like, just to go from 30 to 100, like in that space of time. It's just nonsense. Like, this is nonsense. It's PSG who have done this, and
with
City in a previous era. PSG with the
Neymar
thing. It's crazy. Like, it's just everyone's fees have sort of doubled. You know, it's like,
yeah.
But hey, who can really afford to take risks of that size now? You know, you'd want to be like on Sané. Who could pay 100 million for Sané? But apparently they won't let him move for less. So, okay, I guess he'll probably still be at Man City next season.
Probably. I mean, that's the weird thing, is that a lot of people say Arsenal should buy maybe some young and upcoming talent in the Premier League, but that's expensive.
Yeah.
Well, they're, yeah, they're English really players. Expensive. Well, yeah, particularly if they're English,
yeah.
You know, because they have this English premium and this Premier League premium that comes with it. So, it is going to be it's going to be a hell of a summer. Have you got any plans for the summer? Any downtime? Are you just taking some time off football? There isn't a great deal going on, is there? There's the Nations League, of course, which I don't want to downplay the importance
League, yeah,
of that.
I've almost forgotten about the Nations League.
Well, I'm glad to have reminded you. You wouldn't want to miss it.
Yeah, is that England, Holland, Portugal and Switzerland?
No idea. I genuinely have no idea.
I mean, I hope England... the Champions League final, I suppose, is next week.
Yes.
Should be interesting. There's some alliances there. Man City plus Man United plus Tottenham against Liverpool and Arsenal. Where do Chelsea fit in? Probably on the... No, Chelsea are sitting this one out, aren't they? Chelsea can't figure out who they hate more. Probably they hate Spurs a little bit more. Probably they'd rather Liverpool won because...
Yeah, I think
it would be like, well, they've won it before, whereas Tottenham, you know, we'll never hear the end of it.
Yeah.
If Tottenham win it. So Chelsea, Arsenal, Liverpool versus Man City, Man United and Tottenham.
Mm.
That's the old English Champions League.
It's sort of a tradition where, I meet my brother who's a Liverpool fan and we go watch the Champions League final with a few of the lads.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I want to watch it this year because the potential outcome...
There's a big chance.
There
is a big, big chance.
There is Klopp. I mean, I'm banking on the law of averages. This is on Liverpool's side and Jurgen Klopp's side. He has to win a fucking final at some point.
Who loses three Champions League finals?
No.
Who loses three? I don't know if anyone's done it before. Has anyone lost three?
I don't know.
Maybe some Juventus manager. They've lost as many
maybe.
Fans, more fans than anyone else. But like... This weird holiday that they've had before the game, I think, really plays it into Tottenham's hands.
Can Liverpool sign Gareth Bale before the game?
He's cup tied, I think.
Shit.
But Tottenham were obviously completely falling apart. Like, you've never seen a team so exhausted and so close to collapse. Have just been given this huge this time to recharge and get back to some kind of baseline state, whereas Liverpool, who were in great rhythm, winning a bunch of matches in a row, had this brilliant win against Barcelona, have had loads of time for that to completely dissipate, for the rhythm to desert them.
Do you think losing the Premier League will redouble their efforts in terms of the Champions League, or does that even come into it? Because when you're in a Champions League final, you just want to win a Champions League final.
Well, there's different ways to look at it. On one level, I'd say Liverpool probably feel like they deserve to win because look at the season we've put up.
Yeah.
We deserve it. And some sportsmen have this type of psychology, the reason why Johnny Wilkinson would go out and obsessively, kick 1,500 balls over the bar.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't, if he made a mistake on number 753, he'd go back to zero and do it all again. It was because when he was standing out there on the field at Twickers and he waiting to kick the ball over the bar, he wanted to feel like he deserved for that ball to go over the bar. He wanted to know he put in the work, suffered, worn his joints, down to the bone. And that worked for him, this sense of, I deserve it, therefore I'm going to win. But you can also have the other way of Jesus, lads, imagine we made a ball to this. Jesus, imagine we managed to, everyone would laugh at us forever. The greatest team that never was. The hero 97-point team that lost two Champions League finals in a row. Like, it's almost unthinkable, but that doesn't mean it's impossible.
No.
From Liverpool's point of view, whereas Tottenham, are in... I mean, just the run has been so sensational. The way they've done it, it doesn't matter what's happened, they've found a way to come through it. They should have been knocked out. Like, they were dead in the group stage. They were gone. You probably could have got 10 to one of them getting out of the group, and they did. And then, they managed to knock out City, amazingly, with, missing... half their team. They knock out Ajax, missing Son and Kane. I don't think that they're going, this is a destiny. Like, we have, destiny is on our side. Oh. We march on towards glory. That's what we're looking at. This is a dark time for you.
It really is.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I have any more words to discuss this.
They haven't won it yet, but, you know, I think there's a real, real good chance that both you and your brother are going to be pretty unhappy on the evening of Saturday week.
All right. Well, I do hope you're wrong. I hope you're wrong. Yeah. But thank you as ever for coming in. It's always a great fun, entertaining chat. Ken, thanks a million.
Hello, Audrey. Thanks for having me.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.